I'm in Encino at the Spicy Lime Thai restaurant, enjoying pad ki mao with shrimp and chicken satay, which is always good for those that can handle it spicy. Okay, let's go to the lake. I love all of the different waterfowl that live by this lake. The ducks, geese, and swans come in different shapes, sizes, and colors, yet they all get along so well here. And while they're all birds, I appreciate their variation and individual attributes, which make them unique as species. I often contemplate how their various differences came about. And like the finches of the Galapagos Islands that inspired Charles Darwin, I ponder what their food sources were and how they made a living, so to speak. In regards to the finches, some lived on islands that had nuts that they would crack open, leading to a thicker, more robust beak over time, likely through natural selection. But the exact mechanism is not the point of today's episode. On another island of the Galapagos Archipelago, there are no nuts, and the finches there instead live off of insects in the trees, using a longer, thinner beak to poke into holes in the bark. Both birds were finches, yet their different food sources, over time, affected the shapes of their beaks. This also explains the variation in the skull shape of various hominin species, where hominins such as Homo erectus or Homo habilis existed for millions of years as hunter-gatherers. Their mouths protrude from their face, which in anthropology we call prognathism, and it's considered an archaic or even simian-like trait. On the other hand, the species that I collectively refer to as Cro-Magnon, after the first specimen of its type discovered by a cave between France and Spain, does not have any prognathism, as it likely had an agricultural diet using its back molars to chew, and both examples are hominins. Yet in a taxonomy context, they are considered different species, as they had different and separate lifestyles for millions of years, leading to different appearances, behavior, and just like in the example with the finches that Darwin noticed. While there's always someone who will remark that if Cro-Magnon and Homo erectus could mate and produce viable offspring, doesn't that make them the same species? And the answer is no. There are many examples in nature of different species that can reproduce to create hybrids, but they are understood as being distinct, especially with the advances in genetics made during the last decade. There are similar-looking primates, for example, that have a different number of chromosomes, like the howler monkeys in Tabasco, Mexico. And while a small portion of their population do produce hybrids, the hybrids are not allowed back into the general population of either species and are restricted by the monkeys themselves into a hybrid zone, which in effect is a sort of simian racism. Lions and tigers are distinct. They hunt differently, behave differently, look and act differently, yet they can and have produced ligers, which despite popular opinion are viable as their offspring can also reproduce with either lions or tigers. That said, I came across an article this week quoting Professor Stringer, a British physical anthropologist noted for his work on human evolution and considered one of the world's foremost experts and proponents of the now obsolete and debunked out of Africa replacement model, which argued that human species left Africa and mutated into the various races we have today, killing or replacing the other hominins. We now know conclusively, genetically, that this is false, and that the various races exist today because of hybridization. We are all various mixes of these different hominin species. The article articulated what I just said like this, quote, "One definition of a species is groups of interbreeding natural populations that are reproductively isolated from other such groups, according to Encyclopedia Britannica. However, that definition may not apply for Homo species, as recent research describes evidence of interbreeding between Neanderthals, Homo sapiens, and Denisovans, a hominin species discovered in Denisova Cave in Russia. For example, a 2018 paper published in the journal Nature reported evidence of multiple episodes of interbreeding between Neanderthals and Homo sapiens. Another 2018 paper, also in Nature, described evidence of an ancient human hybrid who had both Neanderthal and Denisovan DNA. This has led some scholars to argue that many Homo species, including ours, should be lumped together, Stringer said. In this paradigm, modern humans are Homo sapiens sapiens, while Neanderthals are Homo sapien Neanderthalis, and Denisovans are Homo sapiens Denisovans. Stringer, however, maintains that humans and Neanderthals are separate species because their bone structure is different. If Neanderthals and Homo sapiens remained separate long enough to evolve such distinct skull shapes, pelvises, and ear bones, they can be regarded as different species, interbreeding or not. He wrote in an article for the Natural History Museum in London. To that, I would add that there are other indicators that we do not all share the same ancestry, history, and therefore have biological complication with compatibility, such as with blood transfusions, or even with reproduction. If mankind evolved from the same African ancestor, then everyone's blood would be compatible, but it's not. Rhesus negative blood type appears suddenly around 35,000 years ago in Cro-Magnon types. Where did the Rh negatives come from? And why does the body of an Rh negative mother carrying an Rh positive child try to reject her own offspring? Humanity isn't one race, but a hybrid species. The article accurately describes ancient interbreeding between Homo sapiens and Neanderthals or Denisovans, two other hominins that lived during the Cro-Magnon era, which is synonymous with Homo sapiens, as Cro-Magnon was the first modern human, a designation that in an anthropological context is different from anatomically correct human. Nothing before Cro-Magnon is considered modern the way anthropologists use the term. That said, there have been other discoveries made through genetic sequencing which speak to further DNA contributions to some races from super archaic species, such as Homo erectus or habilis. The term super archaic implies the specimen are very primitive in terms of behavior and cranial capacity. Another term used is ghost species, as their genetic contribution has been detected but has yet to be officially verified in the fossil record. Present-day sub-Saharan Africans trace up to 19% of their genetic ancestry to these extinct archaic hominin species, likely Homo erectus or Homo habilis, that is not found in the DNA of present-day Asians or present-day Caucasians. So the prevailing notion that we were all hunter-gatherers in Africa, and we all started to domesticate animals, and we all started to establish large-scale farming, and we all started to then evolve into agriculturalists, is false. Some hominins were hunter-gatherers for 3 million years straight, and parts of their lineage still are today, such as the Dinka tribe, who are now considered pastoralists, as cows were introduced into Africa by Eurasians a few thousand years ago. But there are hunter-gatherer tribes in Africa today that only became agricultural because of interaction with other species, namely Cro-Magnon types, who were wearing clothing 30,000 years ago. From the moment they popped onto the fossil record, fully developed, with a massive cranial capacity larger than today's average, about twice the size of Homo erectus, who they interbred with. This hybridization event is allegedly described in ancient stories, such as the Epic of Gilgamesh, which attributes the reason for this interbreeding to upgrade the primitive hominin, or wild man, to create a worker slave race, so that the Sumerians didn't have to work so hard in the fields themselves. Similar stories can be found in India, which describe a simian slave race used by the gods, which were depicted as a different archaic species. Some in the UFO community insist that the hybridization was done via genetic engineering, like in a test tube, as put forth by Zachariah Sitchin. But if we're to go by what the Egyptians and Greeks said via Plato, the interactions seem to be sexual in nature. Quote, "For many generations, as long as the divine nature lasted in them, they were obedient to the laws and well affectioned towards the God whose seed they were, for they possessed true and in every way great spirits. However, over time the Atlanteans became corrupt. When the divine portion began to fade away and became diluted too often and too much with the mortal admixture, and the human nature got the upper hand, they then, being unable to bear their fortune, behaved unseemly, and to him who had an eye to see, grew visibly debased." The time period of Atlantis was during the Pleistocene, or Ice Age, around the same time that these various hominin interbreeding events were taking place. If one were to assume that the specimen known as Cro-Magnon were the Atlanteans, as Cro-Magnon genetics are found on both sides of the Atlantic, such as with haplogroup X, as well as its toolkit, which was essentially the same bifacial tool technology as that of the Solutrians, who incidentally used a tool called an atl-atl, spelled A-T-L-A-T-L, which makes a spear go farther and faster. According to many occult authors, such as Madame Blavatsky and Rudolf Steiner, the remnants of Cro-Magnon, or the seafaring race of the Pleistocene that many call Atlantis, settled in the Caucasus regions around Mount Ararat in present-day Armenia or Turkey at the end of the Ice Age, and at the start of the Holocene disseminated agricultural civilization and Indo-European languages as they branched out in waves, becoming the nobility of the civilizations that they then founded, from the ancient Hittites of Anatolia to the Tocharians of China, the Aryans of Iran and India, to the Minoans, Phoenicians, and original race of North Africa and the Mediterranean, including ancient Egypt, Carthage, Greece, and Rome. In the 1930 lecture of the Arya, 33rd degree Freemason Albert Pike says, quote, "Lepius fixes the date of the reign of Menes, the great monarch of Egypt, at 3,893 and Brunson at 3,643 years BC. The common chronology makes Nimrod or Belus to have lived about 2,500 and Abraham to have been born about 2,000 years before our era. Yet from 7,000 to 10,000 years before Christ, there lived a people in that region which, as the bees send off in the spring their successive swarms, poured out its streams of immigration all over Europe and into India, Bactria, Media, and Persia, everywhere conquering the indigenous races and becoming the Celts of Spain, Britain, and Ireland, and the Northmen of Sweden, Norway, and Denmark, the ancient Goths and modern Germans, the Slavic and Lithuanian races, the Greeks and Romans, the Hindus and the Medians and Persians. You hardly utter a sentence of our English tongue without speaking some words which was spoken in the same sense by that ancient people, 10,000 years ago or more, in the mountain valleys which they first inhabited. You have their idiosyncrasies of thought, the same indelible characteristics of race, for you are their descendants. From them you have your excellencies and your faults, your energy and your vigor of intellect, your philosophical cast of thought, your indomitable resolution, your persistent pursuit of the object of your desire to attain. From them the religious leanings and inclinations of your minds, from them your social institutions and relations, and the foundation stones of your laws, customs, habits, from them all your philosophical and religious doctrines. They were white men, as we are, the superior race in intellect, in manliness, the governing race of the world, the conquering race of all the races. They called themselves Arya, the Aryans, the warlike, or some think the noble. They were the ancestors of the Greek and Roman heroes, as well as of the northern Vikings, and especially prided themselves upon which we call manliness, the virtues of the Roman, who in that word, in vir, a man, perpetuated as we yet do in the words virile and virtue, the old Aryans' word vir, to be valiant, whence their vira, heroic, hero, in viraya, manliness, courage, heroism.
It's a wonderful, tantalizing mystery, isn't it? The Aryans, or to be more precise, the cluster of languages that would become modern English, German, French, Latin and Greek, Persian and Sanskrit. Where did they come from and how did they spread?
Take the word for father, pater in Greek and pater in Latin is pitta in Sanskrit. The word for mother, mater in Latin, mitter in Greek, in Sanskrit is matar. And most amazing, the key word for horse in Sanskrit, asva, is exactly the same thousands of miles away in Lithuania. No philologer could examine all three, said Jones, without believing them to have sprung from some common source. We now know that Jones was right, and though this is now hugely controversial in the subcontinent, most linguists agree the common source lay outside India. In the Rig Veda, there are many clues to the origin of the Sanskrit-speaking peoples. First, the Rig Vedic gods are not originally Indian.
The most important god was Indra. Indra was the god of thunder. He was the god of rain.
The god of thunder and the god of rain.
He brought down the water from sky.
He brought down the water from the sky.
From the sky. Yeah.
Then there's the chariots and horses. Horses are not known in the Indus civilization, and yet they're a key part of the society of the Rig Veda.
Chariots were drawn by the horses. They used to ride the horses, and it was very familiar animal to them. And I think that they tamed the horse at a very early period. This is the first movement of Aryans.
Is this the name they called themselves? What does it mean?
It actually means the civilized, the sabhya, the socialized, civilized
noble,
person.
Yes, refined.
Civilized,
yeah.
Refined person.
Yeah.
And so they use the word Arya.
That's what they call themselves.
Yeah.
So the professor from India says that the Aryans were, quote, the civilized, the superior, the socialized, and the refined. While all that may be true, especially from the perspective of the lower castes, it is not the true etymology of the word. Most Iranians will concur that Aryan means noble, as their great shahs or kings claim to be from an Aryan lineage or race, and were clearly nobility. But that is also not the meaning of the word, although it does fit to describe the social status of this demographic. Although an oversimplification, the Aryans can be seen as sun worshippers, dividing the 26,000-year processional cycle of the sun into 12, symbolically represented by a ram when the sun is in Aries. So, before the roughly 2,000-year age of Aries, they would have associated themselves with Taurus, a cow or bull, which is attested to, for example, by the Minoan civilization. The bull, incidentally, is also depicted in ancient Pleistocene cave art attributed to Cro-Magnon, which some anthropologists claim is the astrotheology used during the Holocene, as many occult authors claim that the solar cults and mystery schools originated in Atlantis. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon, as well as through various other major book outlets. If you'd like to support my work, you could do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description section for those that are interested. Please leave me your thoughts below. Please have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.